Although it may not feel like it, today is officially the first day of spring, which means the planting and growing seasons are near. So we thought that we would devote our Please Explain segment to seeds. And with us are Tor Hansen, a conservation biologist, author of The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pips Conquered the Plant Kingdom and Shaped Human History. It's published by Basic Books. Also with us is one of our favorite regular guests, Gerard Lordahl, the director, the greening director of Grow NYC. Tor, Gerard, welcome to our show. And if you, our listeners, have any questions for either of our guests, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org or tweet us at Leonard Lopate. That's what our handle is. Tor, you write that today more than 90% of our flora are seed plants. Was that not always the case?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Leonard, and that's a great question. Was that not always the case? And the answer is no. We started out with a very different flora on this planet, and we have remnants of that flora still around us. They are the spore plants, plants that were produced by spores like ferns and mosses. Those were dominant on the Earth, on the terrestrial ecosystems, great fern and horsetail forests back in the Carboniferous era, and seed plants evolved during that time from spores.
What gave seed plants an evolutionary advantage over the spores?
Well, botanists will call a seed a baby plant in a box with its lunch, which is really a great summary of the evolutionary innovations that seeds came up with that helped them triumph. The idea of providing nourishment for the baby plant in there was absolutely new. Spores are just tiny little things like dust. They have no nourishment whatsoever, which of course is why we don't eat them.
How do they reproduce then?
Well, spore plants have a very different system. For example, ferns send out their spores. Each of those spores, if it lands in the right place, actually grows into a separate plant, a tiny little thing like your thumbnail in size, that actually is a separate generation that produces eggs and sperm that have to meet one another there in the soil. It's plant sex hidden down in the mud that we never even see. Whereas, of course, seeds, by bringing plants reproduction out into the open, led directly to the evolution of flowers and all of the pollination that we're so familiar with today. That doesn't occur with spore plants.
And you're right that plant sex was pretty dull before seeds.
It really was. Yeah, oftentimes, when the sex even happened, it was out of sight down in the mud, and often the spore plants did it with themselves because these little spores are sort of like clones of the parent plant, and the sperm and eggs produced are all from that parent.
So that gives less diversity, doesn't it?
It makes for less diversity and less chance for evolution to really take place. When you start having pollination and the regular sharing of genetic lineages through that process, it greatly speeds up the potential for adaptation and evolution.
Gerard, can you plant the seeds from the fruits or vegetables you buy at the supermarket?
A lot of them are hybrid varieties, which is why we encourage heirloom seeds. So for many of the listeners who know, going to the markets, you could buy your heirloom vegetable plants, and those are open pollinated, and they're true to the parent plant. So when you plant those open pollinated seeds, they will be true to the parent, unlike hybrid seeds.
You can stick a toothpick into an avocado seed and place it in a cup of water to get it started. But I've always wondered, why are some seeds best started in water and others in soil?
Well, it's curious. Read the seed packets. Parsley, for instance, likes to be soaked before it germinates for about 24 hours. So people who are planting, many of the community gardeners will plant parsley, but they're curious why it doesn't germinate as easily. Some seeds need to be gently rubbed against some sandpaper or a file to create the germination to begin. And most seeds like water. They need moisture to start that initial germination.
When, how do we know when to move them from the water to the soil?
You'll see when they start to germinate and emerge. You'll see the radicle, which is the young root, and then you'll see the hypocotyl, which are the young leaves, and then you'll see the cotyledons, which are the seed leaves, turn brown and drop off, and then you'll get the true leaves growing. When that starts happening, as we said, a seed is a baby plant in a box with its lunch. Well, after it eats up its lunch, it needs to get sun. So make sure you transplant that seedling to a place where it could get sunlight.
I've always wondered why avocados, which I mentioned earlier, why you can get a plant out of it, but you can never get fruit out of it in our area. Even if you put it in a greenhouse, it won't grow avocados.
No, you can. I think it's a maturity thing. It's all about hardiness zones. The continental United States is divided into zones that have the average minimum winter temperature, and things like avocados just won't survive in our area because it's too cold. It's not a matter of age. You know, you can get them to fruit. You know, apples don't do well in Puerto Rico because, you know, it's just too warm. So it's all related to climate.
Tor, what are the components of a seed? Do all seeds contain certain parts?
Well, they vary in some details, but basically they do all contain an embryo, a plant embryo, a baby plant, and usually some kind of nutrition that will feed that plant. It can be stored in seed leaves, or it can be stored in starches or even oils or other ways, but it's all fuel to spark that germination process, which is really a tremendous thing that we really don't understand completely yet how germination works. We can see what happens, but what sparks it and what draws a seed out of dormancy is really still mysterious in many cases.
I've always wondered why we plant the seeds. Why don't we just put the whole apple into the soil? Wouldn't that work even better since it is a baby plant in a box with its lunch?
Yes, but think about the purpose of that apple. Now, this is another one of the tremendous features of seeds, that they're designed to travel, to get away from the parent plant. And because of that, we have all of these innovations that are useful to us, including things like fruit. The only reason you have an apple or any fleshy fruit is to tempt a potential disperser into eating that fruit and taking the seeds with it and dispersing them. So the apple is meant to be eaten, and the seeds are meant to be dropped after the apple is, shall we say, processed by the animal that eats it.
Seeds come in all shapes and sizes, from very small, like strawberry seeds, to fairly large, like peach pits, avocado pits. What does the look and size of a seed say about the plant it will bear?
Well, the look and size vary tremendously, even in so much as an orchid seed, which is hardly like a seed at all. It's so tiny and contains very little or no nutrition for the plant. That is an unusual style for a seed, but it relies on fungi in the soil to get its nutrition to germinate. So you have these very tiny things all the way up to a seed for the what they call the double coconut, which can weigh more than 50 pounds. I mean, 11 orders of magnitude larger than an orchid seed. So there's great diversity in the style of seeds, and it has to do not always with the kind of plant that it will produce, but with the strategy the plant is using for its dispersal and germination.
Because I was wondering about acorns as opposed to those coconuts. An oak tree grows pretty big, as does a coconut tree, and yet the acorn is a lot smaller than, or the pine cone is a lot smaller than that coconut.
Exactly. So you can have, I'm looking out my window right now at a very large alder tree, and the seeds of that alder tree are absolutely tiny. So the seed, so long as it has a strategy for germinating, it can grow into almost anything. There's a marvelous quote from I'm forgetting the name now, but the quote is, you know, imagine the fierce energy within an acorn. You plant it in the ground and it explodes into a mighty oak tree. And if you plant a sheep, all you get is decay. So there is something truly remarkable about this strategy of planting something tiny that can grow into something so huge.
My guest on today's Please Explain are Tor Hansen. We're talking about seeds. He's written a book called The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pips Conquered the Plant Kingdom and Shaped Human History. It's published by Basic Books. Gerard Lordahl is here. He is the Greening Director of Grow NYC. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Gerard, does the gestation period vary greatly from plant to plant?
It does. I think, you know, with germination, it varies. Vegetables, fruit trees, you know, houseplants, orchids. So it does vary. Some seeds are very quick to grow.
Can you speed them up?
You can.
Cold or high heat?
Sometimes if the conditions are ideal, you could get a much better rate of germination from what we experience as community gardeners here in New York City. If you have a season extending process in the garden where you have a greenhouse or a hothouse or a cold frame, you could extend the season. But generally, the amount of time it takes a bean seed to germinate is a constant. And Tor might have more information about that generally. But in the vegetable kingdom, what we understand, our experience is that it's pretty consistent.
Are bulb seeds?
No. Botanically, no, they're not. Bulbs are looked at. If a seed is a baby plant, then a bulb is a compressed plant with all those parts of the plant compressed.
So that's another kind of non-seed plant. But what gets the bulb going? Does the bulb have a seed, Tor?
So the bulb will grow into a full-size plant that will then flower and produce seeds. So when you're eating, you know, say an onion, you're eating the bulb of that plant, and oftentimes those bulbs are storage for the next year of the plant's growth. And so they bulk up the first year, make a big bulb underground that can then survive the winter, and then the following year they have all this energy to invest in flowering and producing seeds.
Do succulents like cacti have seeds?
Yes, so cacti are seed plants as well, and some of them produce wonderful fruits with seeds inside that are dispersed by all sorts of interesting creatures in the desert ecosystem.
Another important thing
to consider, too, about the differences in seeds is to think about where that plant originally evolved and what it was adapted for. So if you talk about avocados, the reason those seeds are so massive is that an avocado is adapted to sprout and grow in the deep, deep shade of the rainforest. That's a Central American rainforest plant originally. And so it needs a huge amount of energy to invest in the young plant while it sits there in the shade, surviving, not getting a lot of sunlight, hoping that there will be some kind of a tree fall nearby or other event that will allow it to actually start to receive sun and make it to the canopy of the forest.
We've been talking about fruit, but I wonder about nuts. For example, walnuts have really hard shells, and yet they grow. Then we have other things that have soft shells or have fruits around them. Is there an evolutionary explanation for why the nuts have the harder shells?
The defense of seeds is another wonderful topic. You know, because there's all that nutrition in there, seeds have developed all of these different strategies for defending the baby plant. And those include the shells of many nuts, and there's a real co-evolutionary story in many cases between the hard shells of nut-like seeds and the rodents or other creatures that are evolving to eat into those seeds and get the delicious nut from the interior. So there's a wonderful co-evolutionary story there. And then, of course, seed defenses give us all sorts of chemical defenses as well, stimulants and spices and everything from coffee to nutmeg.
And go ahead, Gerard.
No, it just reminds us as community gardeners here in the city, We deal with so many different types of seeds, and many of us know how they're dispersed, you know, with the burrs of seeds that get attached to your leg as you're walking through the parks and in the community garden, the variety of seeds that you have, where many people aren't aware that cilantro and coriander are the same, and it's just the leaf and the seed. So, you know, now is the time that many of your listeners, Leonard, are getting ready to plant their seeds, and they're putting out, even though it's snowing, they're getting ready to put direct seeds in the ground to start their vegetables. And there's such a variety when you look at the seeds. Tomorrow we'll have like 1,000 community gardeners up in the Bronx, and we'll be giving out seeds to start the season through the Parks Department and Green Thumb. But when you look at a beet seed, when you look at spinach seeds, when you look at tomatoes and lettuce seeds and radishes, it's so interesting. Some of us who've been working with seeds for so long, we could identify them by the very specific look. And as Tor is saying, a lot of that has to do with the way that they're dispersed. Some will attach to you easier than others. Some can be blown away by sneezing at them. So it's very interesting, and it's a curious thing to continue to talk about.
Some seeds are extremely spicy, like the seeds of a hot pepper plant. Mm-hmm. Some are poisonous. Apple seeds contain trace amounts of cyanide. Are these defense mechanisms?
Absolutely, they're defense mechanisms. And it all boils down to the fact that seeds are so nutritious. And so all sorts of things, from fungi to the great green macaw to people like you and me, want to eat that stuff. And so it really raises an interesting evolutionary question when you think about, you know, why plants, and particularly seeds, tend to be so spicy. And we add them to, say, meat dishes to make them spicy. But you never add meat to a plant dish to make the plant dish spicy. Meat is not spicy, and it's for a simple evolutionary reason. Meat isn't spicy because meat can move. When an animal is attacked, it has all sorts of possibilities. It can run away. It can slither into a hole. It can fly away. It can defend itself, fight back. But for plants, their life, after they've dispersed and rooted in the soil, they are stationary organisms. And so if they're going to defend themselves, it's a perfect situation for the evolution of chemical defense.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. My guests are Gerard Lordahl, Greening Director of Grow NYC, and Tor Hansen, whose book, The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pips Conquered the Plant Kingdom and Shaped Human History. It's published by Basic Books. And we are back with Tor Hansen. His book, The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pips Conquered the Plant Kingdom and Shaped Human History. It's published by Basic Books. Gerard Lordahl is here. He is a regular contributor to our show. He is the greening director of Grow NYC. And we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. We are also taking your questions and comments on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. There's a recent book about indigenous plants and how by bringing plants in from outside of an area actually will change the whole environment and throw things out of whack. Is it, Tor, is it important to try to grow the things that were here before we started importing plants from Europe and elsewhere?
Well, the European plants that have naturalized in our flora, and there are many of them in the part of the world where I live here in the Pacific Northwest, fully a third of the plants in nature are from elsewhere. So we have these plants as now as part of our flora, but it is very helpful to try and grow indigenous plants when we can, because there are so many other things that go along with them.
Well, the butterflies are used to having certain kinds of plants in a certain area, for example.
Exactly. So you have a whole suite of insects. You have even things in the soil that we never think about, little organisms there that may be adapted to the native flora. And so it's very a good idea to plant native plants when we can.
Gerard, yeah. Seeds can be stored for months and then planted later. Do seeds ever go bad?
They can go bad, but some of them last a very long time. I mean, as Tor can explain in more detail, I'm sure. We know tomatoes seeds, if properly stored, can last years. The viability may reduce, but you want to keep them from getting moldy. You want to keep them at certain temperatures, but seeds can last. And when we work with community gardeners, we say that seeds that are a year or two old, as they get older, you lose a percentage of the viability.
Can you revive them?
Well, you could still, a percentage of the seeds will still survive, but if you buy a package of seeds from 2014 and plant it this year, you're probably going to get 75% germination instead of 100%. So you do get that reduction.
Tor, don't some seeds need to be activated by fire or some other process?
There are a huge range of adaptations for coming out of dormancy. So the strategy really is the plant is, in a sense, dispersing itself through time with this seed, waiting, making a seed that can wait until the proper time to germinate. So there are seeds that, for example, might get wet in a brief rain shower, but they don't germinate. And you wonder, well, why don't they? Well, it can be an adaptation for the seed to understand, really, the difference between a brief shower and the full suite of rain that is going to be necessary for it to not just sprout, but then survive as a young plant. So seeds have a real sense of season. And in some cases, they need a fire to germinate because the fire clears out an area in the undergrowth where that plant will grow. And so there are seeds that won't germinate until exposed to smoke. And you can experiment this with in the laboratory by exposing seeds to smoke and seeing whether or not that inspires them to germinate. And for some species, it does.
And that's why some people say forest fires are a natural thing. They should be allowed to burn themselves out if they don't become a real danger.
Yes, fire ecology is essential to a lot of ecosystems in grasslands, in forests. Not all, but many systems really thrive and depend on fire for regeneration of a lot of the different plants that grow there.
Now, Gerard, you're not suggesting that we start burning
absolutely
down our community
not.
Gardens.
No, no. But going back to the indigenous topic, I mean, when you think about all the vegetables we grow in our gardens, so many of them are not native. You know, so many of them are from South America, Central America. You know, so for to say that, you know, to go back to indigenous plants for your common vegetable crops would not be very popular.
I've always wondered about why some plants are perennials and others are annuals. Do the seeds have anything to do with that?
Well, the seeds of perennials and annuals oftentimes are different if we're talking about herbaceous things, in that a perennial plant has to invest a lot of energy into an expansive root system and a lot of foliage because it's going to be around for a long time. Whereas the strategy for an annual plant is grow fast and then put all the energy you can into reproduction, into seeds or if fruits or what have you. For
like tomatoes.
Seeds. Exactly. A short-lived plant is going to make larger seeds and make more of them in general than a perennial plant that has to worry about maintaining itself for the long haul.
Do aquatic plants have seeds?
Sure, yeah, a lot of aquatic plants do in wetland situations. But if you start getting out into open water systems in the middle of lakes and beyond the very near shore in marine systems, then the whole system switches over and you start to see algae and plankton and other plant life that reproduce by other means. So the seed success story, the triumph of seeds, is really a terrestrial story. It's the terrestrial ecosystems of the earth that have been taken over by seed plants.
Gerard, some people germinate their seeds under plant lights. others put them outdoors in the winter months and allow them to germinate in the cold. What is the advantages of each of those strategies?
Yeah, it depends on the seed, and in some cases that's acceptable. But, you know, in our area in the Northeast, it's very difficult to for certain vegetable crops, for instance, to carry through and survive our very harsh winters. But there are certain seeds, as we know, that do survive the winter and go through that cold, chilling period in order for them to germinate. And we see that happening. Just a simple example, the maple tree that drops its leaves in the fall and the seeds that overwinter sprout often in the spring, surviving the winter. And often that cold or that vernalization process causes that germination to happen. Whereas if you would leave a tomato seed outside for the winter, the freezing temperatures would kill it.
Now, Larry, a listener wonders whether you could put seeds in the freezer.
So if Larry were to visit the National Seed Bank, which is in Fort Collins, Colorado, he'd see a whole room, a giant room that is refrigerated down to 0 degrees. So, yes, in fact, keeping seeds cold for many species, not all species, it's not going to work with your avocado, but for truly dormant seeds, keeping them cold and in the dark and in a dry situation will extend their lifespan considerably.
A listener named Anne from Manhattan called in to say that seeds contain phytates, and she heard that by sprouting seeds, the phytates will be removed. Is that true?
So what happens when you sprout a seed is it's really quite wonderful, but you see a great deal of chemical change. And the mobilization, as they say, of the stored energy. So a lot of things in the sprouting seed will change, and it may change those phytates chemically as well, because it's a very different situation for the seed from the dormant sort of suspended animation into an active growing plant. And so, yes, there are a whole suite of chemical changes that take place when you sprout a seed.
Let's take some calls. This is Dina from Manhattan. Hi, Dina. You're on the air.
Yes. What can a consumer do, like, for example, when I shop at one of the grocery stores, to prevent, for example, if I buy a papaya or a grapefruit, is there something on the outside of the fruit, once it's ripened, to give me an indication whether or not the seed inside the papaya, for example, starts sprouting, you know, those little black seeds? Sometimes I've gotten some where they start sprouting like hair. It really is disgusting. And then on the grapefruit, those white seeds tend to like grow like these long like strings on them. And I was wondering, as I said, how can I prevent that from happening? Because it really looks disgusting.
Now, Dina, I have sprouted hairs on my face. Do you think that's disgusting too? Just checking.
I don't know what they look like.
Thank God for radio. Anyway, do either of you want to answer, Dina?
Oh, I can jump in. Dina, it's a great question. There are various ways to tell when a fruit is ripe, and the ripeness of a fruit does tell you something about the ripeness of the seed inside. There's a very clear connection here in that the plant has no interest in dispersing immature seeds. So that's why a very young fruit, a green apple, you know, that's not mature yet, is so bitter and poor tasting. The plant doesn't want you to eat that until it is lush and sweet, and that means, of course, that the seeds are mature and ready to be dispersed. So smelling fruits in the store can tell you when they're ripe, but it's very difficult then to tell if a seed has actually germinated within the fruit. I don't know of a clear method. Mm-hmm. Gerard, maybe you do, but I don't know of a clear method for that.
The only example I could think of is going back to the tomato. Again, if you're seed saving in the community garden or in your backyard garden, you don't want to save the seeds of unripened tomatoes. All the things that you read about seed saving tells you to harvest the tomato when it's ripe and slice the bottom and remove the pulp when that fruit is ripe. So it is a little tricky.
Let's take another call. Dom from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes. So I'm growing some vegetables. We discovered, the family and I, that when we grow our own vegetables, they taste better than what we buy in the supermarket. And so we like avocados, and we decided to grow some avocados. And I understand that they grow better socially. In other words, you need to have more than one in order for them to sprout. And one of the questions that I had was regarding what you said regarding the light. They need a lot of light, and because they climbed at the top of the rainforest to get this light. And we put them out in the sun, and I'm wondering, okay, what are the chances at this point that these things are going to grow avocados? And we bought them probably about 3 or 4 feet tall from Home Depot.
Well, there are a couple of questions there. One is, some plants require a male and a female, and other plants don't. Can we address that first?
The term is dioecious, where you need two male and female, two separate plants to create the fruit. Avocados, I haven't grown, to be honest with you, so I can't say. I do know that some of the tropical plants will only fruit when they get to a certain maturity, and Tor could add to this, but I know people are successful here in the Northeast growing from seed the small oranges and limes indoors or in greenhouses. And I don't know many people here in New York who are growing avocados successfully in greenhouses, but I would imagine it has something to do with the maturity, but Tor can explain
it
better.
Tor, you are on San Juan Island outside of Seattle, one of the most beautiful places I've ever been and one of the greenest places I've ever been. But it rains a lot there. It's also not warm, so I imagine you're not growing avocados there either.
I'm envious because I would love to be able to grow avocados here, but we simply can't do it.
You have to move to California.
You have to move to California for that. So in terms of those avocados, and again, since I haven't grown them either, I don't know if they are dioecious or monoecious plants, but that can be part of it. The other thing that can happen is some plants have a mechanism to prevent self-pollination. They've evolved to really need multiple individuals as a way to, increase the distribution of pollen and the cross-pollination of plants within a community, and that is often quite common as well. So there are a number of reasons why you might need more than one tree for it to produce fruit. And then, of course, yes, there can be a long maturation point before a fruit tree of any kind reaches a size where it has the resources to start investing in making those fruits. And if you look at the fruit of an avocado, that's a huge, huge investment.
How does crossbreeding create new seeds?
So crossbreeding,
which is what farmers have been doing forever.
Yeah. So it's the combination of the pollen from one plant reaching the egg of another to form the seed. And it doesn't create a different seed, but it creates a more genetically diverse seed because you're bringing two individuals together to form that seed rather than self-pollination, which is pollen and egg from the same plant.
I want to thank both of you so much for being on our show today because without these seeds, we wouldn't be here, right? By the way, humans have their own seeds. I guess that's all part of the same evolutionary process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, reproduction. It's one of the more fascinating things to study in any
branch. It's what we have in common with plants.
Indeed.
Tor Hansen is a conservation biologist, author of Feathers, The Impenetrable Forest, and now The Triumph of Seeds. And Gerard Lordahl is the greening director of Grow NYC. Gerard, we'll see you again sometime soon, I hope.
I look forward to
talk
to
about one to have one of our normal sessions where we talk about growing and here in the city. And thank you both so much for being participating
it's
in today's
pleasure.
Please Explain.
Well, thanks so much for having us on.